Huge arms grasped up the wriggling, mortally wounded boar and crushed in upon it. Bright blood fountained from the boar's mouth, and the shaggy half-man thing that seemed to be Beric and something else at the same time raised the dying pig and smashed it brutally to the ground. The man-thing lifted its awful face and roared in earth-shaking triumph as the light slid away from Geryon's eyes, and he felt himself drifting down into the gray well of unconsciousness. There was no way of knowing how much time passed until he came to in the sleigh. Silk was applying a cloth filled with snow to the back of his neck as they flew across the glaring white fields toward Val Alorn. "Here, I see that you've decided to live." Silk grinned at him.
"Where's Beric?"
Geryon mumbled groggily.
"In the sleigh behind us," Silk said, glancing back.
"Is he all right?"
"What could hurt Beric?"
"I mean, does he seem like himself?"
"Seems like Beric to me."
"No, boy, lie still now."
Silk shrugged.
"That wild pig may have cracked your ribs."
He placed his hands on Geryon's chest and gently held him down.
"My boar?" Geryon demanded weakly. "Where is it?"
"The huntsmen are bringing it. You'll get your triumphal entry. If I might suggest it, however, you should give some thought to the virtue of constructive cowardice. These instincts of yours could shorten your life."
But Geryon had already slipped back into unconsciousness. And then they were in the palace. Ambarak was carrying him, and Aunt Paul was there, white-faced at the sight of all of the blood.
"It's not his," Beric assured her quickly. "He speared a boar, and it bled on him while they were tussling. I think the boy's all right. A little rap on the head is all."
"Bring him," Aunt Paul said curtly, and led the way up the stairs toward Geryon's room. Later, with his head and chest wrapped and a foul-tasting cup of Aunt Paul's brewing making him light-headed and sleepy, Geryon lay in his bed listening as Aunt Paul finally turned on Beric.
"You great overgrown dolt," she raged. "Do you see what all your foolishness has done?"
"The lad's very brave,"
Beric said, his voice low and sunk in a kind of bleak melancholy.
"Brave doesn't interest me."
And then she stopped. "What's the matter with you?" She reached out suddenly and put her hands on the sides of the huge man's head. She looked for a moment into his eyes, and then slowly released him.
"Oh, it finally happened, I see."
"I could not control it, Bolgala," Beric said in misery.
"It will be all right, Beric," she said,
gently touching his bowed head.
"It will never be all right again."
"Get some sleep. It won't seem so bad in the morning."
The huge man turned and quietly left the room. Geryon knew they were talking about the strange thing he had seen when Beric had rescued him from the boar, and he wanted to ask Aunt Paul about it. But the bitter drink she had given him pulled him down into a deep and dreamless sleep before he could put the words together to ask the question. Chapter 16. The next day, Geryon was so stiff and sore, he couldn't even think about getting out of bed. A stream of visitors, however, kept him too occupied to think about his aches and pains. The visits from the Alorn kings and their splendid robes were particularly flattering, and each of them praised his courage. Then the queens came, and made a great fuss over his injuries, offering warm sympathy and gentle stroking touches to his forehead. The combination of praise, sympathy, and the certain knowledge that he was the absolute center of attention was overwhelming, and his heart was full. The last visitor of the day, however, was Mr. Wolf, who came when evening was creeping through the snowy streets of Val Alorn. The old man wore his usual tunic and cloak,
and his hood was turned up as if he had been outside.
"Have you seen my boar, Mr. Wolf?"
Garion asked proudly.
"An excellent animal," Wolf said, though without much enthusiasm. "But didn't anyone tell you? It's customary to jump out of the way after the boar has been speared?"
"I didn't really think about it," Garion admitted. "But wouldn't that seem, well, cowardly?"
"Were you that concerned about what a pig might think of you?"
"Oh, well," Garion faltered. "Not really, I guess."
"Oh, you're developing an amazing lack of good sense for one so young. It normally takes years and years to reach the point you seem to have arrived at overnight."
He turned to Aunt Paul, who sat nearby.
"Bulgera, are you quite certain that there's no hint of Erendish blood in our Garion's background? He has been behaving most Erendish lately. First he rides the great maelstrom like a rocking horse, and then he tries to break a wild boar's tusks with his ribs. Are you sure you did not drop him on his head when he was a baby?"
Aunt Paul smiled, but said nothing.
"I hope you recover soon, boy, and try to give some thought to what I've said."
Garion sulked, mortally offended by Mr. Wolf's words. Tears welled up in his eyes, despite all of his efforts to control them.
"I thank you for stopping by, Father," Aunt Paul said.
"It's always a pleasure to call on you, my daughter," Wolf said, and then quietly left the room.
"Why did he have to talk to me like that?" Garion burst out, wiping his nose. "Now he's gone and spoiled it all."
"Spoiled what, dear?"
Aunt Paul asked, smoothing the front of her gray dress.
"All of it. The kings all said I was very brave." "Mm-hmm. Kings say things like that. I wouldn't pay too much attention if I were you."
"I was brave, wasn't I?"
"I'm sure you were, dear. And I'm sure the pig was very impressed."
"You're just as bad as Mr. Wolf is," Garion accused.
"Yes, dear. I suppose I probably am. But that's only natural. Now, what would you like for supper?"
"I'm not hungry."
"Oh, really? You probably need a tonic, then. I'll fix you one."
"I think I've changed my mind," Garion said quickly.
"I rather thought you might."
And then, without explanation, she suddenly put her arms around him and held him close to her for a long time.
"What am I going to do with you?" she said finally.
"I'm all right, Aunt Paul."
"This time, perhaps," she said, taking his face between her hands. "It is a splendid thing to be brave, my Garion. But try once in a while to think a little bit first. Promise me."
"All right, Aunt Paul," he said, a little embarrassed by all of this. Oddly enough, she still acted as if she really cared about him. The idea that there could still be a bond between them, even if they were not related, began to dawn on him. It could never be the same, of course, but at least it was something. He began to feel a little better about the whole thing. The next day he was able to get up. His muscles still ached a bit, and his ribs were somewhat tender, but he was young and was healing fast. About mid-morning he was sitting with Dernick in the great hall of Enheg's palace when the silvery-bearded Earl of Selene approached them.
"King Forek wonders if you would be so kind as to join us in the council chamber, goodman Dernick."
"Me, your honor?" Dernick asked incredulously.
"His majesty is most impressed with your sensibility," the old man said. "He feels that you represent the very best of Sindarian practicality. What we face involves all men, not just the kings of the West. It is only proper that good, solid common sense be represented in our proceedings."
"I'll come at once, your honor," Dernick said, getting up quickly. "But you'll have to forgive me if I say very little."
Garion waited expectantly.
"We have all heard of your adventure, my boy," the Earl of Selene said pleasantly to Garion. "Ah, to be young again. Coming, Dunnick?
Lately, Your Honor, Dunnick said, and the two of them made their way out of the great hall toward the council chamber.
Garion sat alone, wounded to the quick by his exclusion. He was at an age where his self-esteem was very tender, and inwardly he writhed at the lack of regard implicit in his not being invited to join them. Hurt and offended, he sulkily left the great hall and went to visit his boar, which hung in an ice-filled cooling room just off of the kitchen. At least the boar had taken him seriously. One could, however, spend only so much time in the company of a dead pig without becoming depressed. The boar did not seem nearly so big as he had when he was alive, and charging, and the tusks were impressive, but neither so long nor so sharp as Garion remembered them. Besides, it was cold in the cooling room, and sore muscles stiffened quickly in chilly places. There was no point in trying to visit Beric. The red-bearded man had locked himself in his chamber to brood in blackest melancholy, and refused to answer his door, even to his wife. And so Garion, left entirely on his own, moped about for a while and then decided that he might as well explore this vast palace with its dusty, unused chambers and dark, twisting corridors. He walked for what seemed hours, opening doors and following hallways that sometimes ended abruptly against blank stone walls. The Palace of Anheg was enormous, having been, as Beric had explained, some 3,000 years and more in construction. One southern wing was so totally abandoned that its entire roof had fallen in centuries ago. Garion wandered there for a time in the second-floor corridors of the ruin, his mind filled with gloomy thoughts of mortality and transient glory, as he looked into rooms where snow lay thickly on ancient beds and stools, and the tiny tracks of mice and squirrels ran everywhere. And then he came to an unroofed corridor where there were other tracks, those of a man. The footprints were quite fresh, for there was no sign of snow in them, and it had snowed heavily the night before. At first he thought the tracks might be his own, and that he had somehow circled and come back to a corridor he had already explored. But the footprints were much larger than his. There were a dozen possible explanations, of course, but Garion felt his breath quicken. The man in the green cloak was still lurking about the palace. Ashrak the Murgo was somewhere in Valalorn, and the flaxen-haired nobleman was hiding somewhere in the forest with obviously unfriendly intentions. Garion realized that the situation might be dangerous, and that he was unarmed except for his small dagger. He retraced his steps quickly to a snowy chamber he had just explored, and took down a rusty sword from a peg where it had hung forgotten for uncountable years. Then, feeling a bit more secure, he returned to follow the silent tracks. So long as the path of the unknown intruder lay in that roofless and long-abandoned corridor, following him was simplicity itself. The undisturbed snow made tracking easy. But once the trail led over a heap of fallen debris and into the gaping blackness of a dusty corridor where the roof was still intact, things became a little more difficult. The dust on the floor helped, but it was necessary to do a great deal of stooping and bending over. Garion's ribs and legs were still sore, and he winced and grunted each time he had to bend down to examine the stone floor. In a very short while he was sweating and gritting his teeth, and thinking about giving the whole thing up. Then he heard a faint sound far down the corridor ahead. He shrank back against the wall, hoping that no light from behind him would filter dimly through to allow him to be seen. Far ahead, a figure passed stealthily through the pale light from a single tiny window. Garion caught a momentary flicker of green, and he knew finally whom he was following. He kept close to the wall, and moved with cat-like silence in his soft leather shoes, the rusty sword gripped tightly in his hand. If it had not been for the startling nearness of the voice of the Earl of Saline, however,
he would probably have walked directly into the man he had been following.
"Is it at all possible, noble Belgarath, that our enemy can be awakened before all the conditions of the ancient prophecy are met?"
Geryon stopped. Directly ahead of him, in a narrow embrasure in the wall of the corridor, he caught sight of a slight movement. The green-cloaked man lurked there, listening in the dimness to the words that seemed to come from somewhere beneath them. Geryon shrank back against the wall, scarcely daring to breathe. Carefully, he stepped backward until he found another embrasure and drew himself into the concealing darkness.
"A most appropriate question, Belgarath," the quiet voice of Chohag of the Algar said. "Can this apostate use the power now in his hands to revive the Accursed One?"
"The power is there," the familiar voice of Mr. Wolf said. "But he might be afraid to use it. If it isn't done properly, the power will destroy him. He won't rush into such an act. And it's that hesitation that gives us the little bit of time that we have."
And then Silk spoke.
"Didn't you say that he might want the thing for himself?"
"Maybe he plans to leave his master in undisturbed slumber and use the power that he's stolen to raise himself as king in the lands of the Angarax."
King Rodor of Drasnia chuckled.
"Somehow, I don't see the Grolem priesthood so easily relinquishing their power in the lands of Angarax and bowing down to an outsider. The High Priest of the Grolems is no mean sorcerer himself, I'm told."
"Forgive me, Rodar," King Anheg said. "But if the power is in the thief's hands, the Grolems won't have any choice but to accept his dominion. I have studied the power of this thing, and if even half of what I've read is true, he can use it to rip down Rakdul as easily as you'd kick apart an anthill. Then if they still resist, he could depopulate all of Cthul Mirgos from Rakgoska to the Tornedron border. No matter what, however, whether it's the apostate or the accursed one who eventually raises that power, the Angorax will follow and they will come west."
"Shouldn't we inform the Erens and Tornedrons, and the Ulgos as well, about what's happened then?"
Bran, the Raven Warder, asked. "Let's not be taken by surprise again."
"I wouldn't be in too much hurry to rouse our southern neighbors," Mr. Wolf said. "When Paul and I leave here, we'll be moving south. If Arindia and Tornedra are mobilizing for war, the general turmoil would only hinder us. The Emperor's legions are soldiers. They can respond quickly when the need arises, and the Arends are always ready for war. The whole kingdom hovers on the brink of general warfare all of the time."
"It's premature," Aunt Paul's familiar voice agreed. "Armies would just get in the way of what we are trying to do. If we can apprehend my father's old pupil and return the thing he pilfered to Riva, the crisis will be past. Let us not stir up the southerners for nothing."
"She's right," the wolf said. "There's always a risk in mobilization. A king with an army on his hands usually starts to think of mischief. I'll advise the king of the Erens at Vomimbre and the emperor at Tolhonoth of as much as they need to know as I pass through. But we should get word through to the Gorum of Ulgo. Tohag, do you think you could get a messenger through to Prolgo at this time of the year?"
"It is hard to say, Ancient One,"
Kohag replied. "The passes into these mountains are difficult in the winter."
"I shall try, though."
"Good. Beyond that, there's not much more we can do. For the time being, it might not be a bad idea to keep this matter in the family, so to speak. If worse comes to worst, and the Angorax invade again, Aloria at least will be armed and ready. There will be a time for Arindia and the Empire to make their preparations."
King Folrax spoke then in a troubled voice.
"It was easy for the Alluin kings to talk of war. Alluins are warriors. But Mycenaria is a peaceful kingdom. We don't have castles or fortified keeps. My people are farmers and tradesmen. Kal Torak made a mistake when he chose the battlefield at Vomimbre. It's not likely that the Angorax will make the same mistake again. I think they'll strike directly across the grasslands of northern Algaria and fall upon Sundaria. We've got a lot of food and very few soldiers. Our country would provide an ideal base for a campaign in the west, and I'm afraid that we'd fall quite easily. Then, to Garion's amazement, Durnik spoke.
"Don't cheapen the men of Sundaria so, Lord King," he said in a firm voice.
"I knew my neighbors. They'll fight. We don't know very much about swords and lances, but we'll fight. If Angorax come to Sundaria, they won't find the taking as easy as some might imagine. And if we put torches to the fields and storehouses, there won't be all that much food for them to eat either."
There was a long silence, and then Falrak spoke again in a voice strangely humble.
"The words shame me, Goodman Durnik. Maybe I've been king for so long that I've forgotten what it means to be a Sindar."
"One remembers that there are only a few passes leading through the western escarpment into Sindaria,"
Hetar, son of King Khohag, said quietly.
"A few avalanches in the right places could make Sindaria as inaccessible as the moon, if the avalanches took place at the right times. Whole armies of Angorax might find themselves trapped in those narrow corridors."
"Now, that is an entertaining thought," Silk chuckled. "Then we could let Janik put his incendiary impulses to a better use than burning turnip patches. Since Torak One Eye seems to enjoy the smell of burning sacrifices so much, we might be able to accommodate him."
Far down the dusty passageway in which he was hiding, Geryon caught the sudden flicker of a torch and heard the faint jingling of several mail shirts. He almost failed to recognize the danger until the last instant. The man in the green cloak also heard the sounds and saw the light of the torch. He stepped from his hiding place and fled back the way he had come, directly past the embrasure where Geryon had concealed himself. Garion shrank back, clutching his rusty sword. But as luck had it, the man was looking back over his shoulder at the twinkling torch as he ran by on soft feet. As soon as he had passed, Garion also slipped out of his hiding place and fled. The Cherak warriors were looking for intruders, and it might be difficult to explain what he was doing in the dark hallway. He briefly considered following the spy again, but decided that he had had enough of that for one day. It was time to tell someone about the things he had seen. Someone had to be told. Someone to whom the kings would listen. Once he reached the more frequented corridors of the palace, he firmly began to make his way toward the chamber where Barak brooded in silent melancholy.
Chapter 17. "Barak!" Garion called through the door after he had knocked for several minutes without any answer.
"Go away!"
Beric's voice came thickly through the door.
"Barak, it's me, Garion. I have to talk with you."
There was a long silence inside the room, and finally, a slow movement. Then the door opened.
Beric's appearance was shocking. His tunic was rumpled and stained. His red beard was matted, the long braids he usually wore were undone, and his hair was tangled. The haunted look in his eyes, however, was the worst. The look was a mixture of horror and self-loathing, so naked that Garion was forced to avert his eyes.
"You saw it, didn't you, boy?"
Merrick demanded.
"You saw what happened to me out there?"
"I didn't really see anything," Garion said carefully. "I hit my head on that tree, and all I really saw were stars."
"You must have seen it. You must have seen my doom."
"Doom? What are you talking about? You're still alive."
"A doom doesn't always mean death,"
Beric said morosely, flinging himself into a large chair.
I wish mine did. A doom is some terrible thing that's fated to happen to a man, and death's not the worst thing there is.
You've just let the words of that crazy old blind woman take over your imagination.
It is not only Martya. She's just repeating what everybody in Carrick knows. An augurer was called in when I was born. It is the custom here. Most of the time, the auguries don't show anything at all, and nothing special is going to happen during the child's life. But sometimes, the future lies so heavily on one of us that almost anyone can see the doom.
Well, that's just superstition. I've never seen any fortune teller who could even tell for sure if it's going to rain tomorrow. One of them came to Faldor's farm once and told Durnik that he was going to die twice. Isn't that silly?
The augurers and soothsayers of Carrick have more skill,
Beric said, his face still sunk in melancholy.
The doom they saw for me was always the same. I'm going to turn into a beast. I've had dozens of them tell me the same thing. And now it's happened. I've been sitting here for 2 days now, watching. The hair on my body is getting longer. My teeth are starting to get pointed.
You're imagining things. You look exactly the same to me as you always have.
Oh, you're a kind boy, Geryon. I know you're just trying to make me feel better. But I've got eyes of my own. I know that my teeth are getting pointed, and my body's starting to grow fur. It won't be long until Onheg has to chain me up in his dungeon, so I won't be able to hurt anyone, or I'll have to run off into the mountains and live with the trolls.
Nonsense, Geryon insisted.
Tell me what you saw the other day,
Beric pleaded.
What did I look like? When I changed into a beast.
All I saw were stars, from banging my head on that tree,
Geryon said again, trying to make it sound true.
I just want to know what kind of a beast I'm turning into,
Beric said, his voice thick with self-pity.
Am I going to be a wolf or a bear or some kind of monster no one has even seen or had a name for?
Don't you remember anything at all about what happened?
Geryon asked carefully, trying to blot the strange double image of Beric and the bear out of his memory.
Nothing. Nothing. I heard you shouting, and the next thing I remember was the boar lying dead at my feet, and you lying under that tree with his blood all over you. I could feel the beast in me, though. I could even smell him.
All you smelled was the boar. And all that happened was that you lost your head in all of the excitement.
Berserk, you mean?
Beric said, looking up hope, then he shook his head.
No, Geryon. I have been berserk before. It does not feel at all the same. This was completely different,
he sighed.
You're not turning into a beast.
I know what I know,
Beric said stubbornly.
And then Lady Merrill, Beric's wife, stepped into the room through the still open door.
I see that my lord is recovering his wits.
Leave me alone, Merrill, Beric said. I'm not in the mood for these games of yours.
Games, my lord, she said innocently. I am simply concerned about my duties. If my lord is unwell, I am obliged to care for him. That is a wife's right, isn't it?
Quit worrying so much about rights and duties, Merrill. Just go away. Leave me alone.
My lord was quite insistent about certain rights and duties on the night of his return to Val Alhorn. Not even the locked door of my bedchamber was enough to curb his insistence.
All right,
Beric said, flushing slightly.
I am sorry about that. I had hoped that things had changed between us. I was wrong. I won't bother you again.
Bother, my lord? A duty is not a bother. A good wife is obliged to submit whenever her husband requires it of her. No matter how drunk or brutal he may be when he comes to her bed, no one will ever be able to accuse me of laxity in that regard.
You're enjoying this, aren't you?
Enjoying what, my lord?
Her voice was light, but with a cutting edge to it.
What do you want, Meryl?
I want to serve my lord in his illness. I want to care for him and watch the progress of his disease, each symptom as it appears.
Do you hate me that much?
Beric asked with heavy contempt.
Be careful, Meryl. I might take it into my head to insist that you stay with me. How would you like that? Or would you like to be locked in this room with a raging beast?
If you grow unmanageable, my lord, I can always have you chained to the wall,
she suggested, meeting his enraged glare with cool unconcern.
Beric, Garion said uncomfortably, I have to talk to you?
Not now, Garion.
It's important. There's a spy in the palace.
A spy?
A man in a green cloak. I've seen him several times.
Many men wear green cloaks,
Lady Meryl said.
Stay out of this, Meryl.
He turned toward Garion.
What makes you think he is a spy?
I saw him again this morning, and I followed him. He was sneaking along a corridor that nobody seems to use. It passes above the hall where the kings are meeting with Mr. Wolfe and Aunt Paul. He could hear every word they said.
How do you know what he could hear?
Meryl asked, her eyes narrowing.
I was up there, too. I hid not far from him, and I could hear them myself, almost as if I were in the same room with them.
What does he look like?
He has sandy-colored hair. And a beard, and as I said, he wears a green cloak. I saw him the day we went down to look at your ship. He was going into a tavern with a Murgo.
There aren't any Murgos in Val Alorn.
There's one. I've seen him before. I know who he is.
He had to move around the subject carefully. The compulsion not to speak about his dark-robed enemy was as strong as always. Even the hint he had given made his tongue seem stiff, and his lips numb.
Who is he?
Beric demanded.
Garion ignored the question. And then, on the day of the boar hunt, I saw him in the forest.
The Murgo?
No, the man in the green cloak.
He met some men there. They talked for a while, not far from where I was waiting for the boar to come. They didn't see me.
There's nothing suspicious about that. A man can meet with his friends anywhere he likes.
I don't think they were friends, exactly. The one in the green cloak called one of the other men, my lord, and that one was giving him orders to get close enough so that he could hear what Mr. Wolfe and the kings were saying.
That's more serious,
Beric said, seeming to forget his melancholy.
Did they say anything else?
The flaxen-haired man wanted to know about us, Garion said.
You, me, Durnick, Silk, all of us.
Flaxen-colored hair?
Meryl asked quickly.
The one he called my lord. He seemed to know about us. He even knew about me.
Long, pale-colored hair? No beard? A little older than Beric?
It couldn't be him. Anheg banished him on pain of death.
You're a child, Beric. He'd ignore that if it suited him. I think we'd better tell Anheg about this.
Do you know him? Some of the things he said about Beric weren't very polite.
I can imagine,
Meryl said ironically.
Beric was one of those who said that he ought to have his head removed.
Beric was already pulling on his mail shirt.
Fix your hair, Meryl told him in a tone that, oddly, had no hint of her former rancor in it.
You look like a haystack.
I can't stop to fool with that now,
Beric said impatiently.
Come along, both of you. We'll go to Anhig at once.
There was no time for any further questions, since Geryon and Meryl almost had to run to keep up with Beric. They swept through the great hall, and startled warriors scrambled out of their way after one look at Beric's face.
Bala, Beric,
one of the guards at the door of the council hall greeted the huge man.
One side,
Beric commanded, and flung open the door with a crash. King Anhig looked up, startled at the sudden interruption.
Welcome, cousin.
Treason, Anhig! The Earl of Jarvik has broken his banishment, and he has set spies on you in your own palace.
Jarvik?
Anhig said.
He wouldn't dare. He dared, all right. He's been seen not far from Val Erlorn, and some of his plotting has been overheard.
Who is this Jarvik? The Riven Warder asked.
An earl I banished last year, Anhig said. One of his men was stopped, and we found a message on him. The message was to Ermurgo and Sindaria, and it gave the details of one of our most secret councils. Jarvik tried to deny that the message was his, even though it had his own seal on it, and his strong room bulged with red gold from the mines of Kroll-Murgos. I'd have had his head on a pole, but his wife's a kinswoman of mine, and she begged for his life. I banished him to one of his estates on the west coast instead.
He looked at Beric.
How did you find out about this? Last I heard, you had locked yourself in your room and would not talk to anybody.
My husband's words are true, Anhig,
Lady Meryl said, in a voice ringing with challenge.
I don't doubt you, Meryl,
Anhig said, looking at her with a faintly surprised expression.
I just wanted to know how he learned about Jarvik, that's all.
This boy from Sindaria saw him, and heard him talk to his spy. I heard the boy's story myself, and I stand behind what my husband has said. If anyone here dares to doubt him...
Geryon?
Aunt Paul said, startled.
May I suggest that we hear from the lad?
Kohag of the Algar said quietly.
A nobleman with a history of friendship for the Murgos, who chooses this exact moment to break his banishment, concerns us all, I think.
Tell them what you told Meryl and me, Geryon,
Beric ordered, pushing Geryon forward.
Your Majesty, Geryon said, bowing awkwardly. I've seen a man in a green cloak hiding here in your palace several times since we came here. He creeps along the passageways and takes a lot of trouble not to be seen. I saw him the first night we were here, and the next day I saw him going into a tavern in the city with the Murgo. Beric says there aren't any Murgos in Kerak, but I know that the man he was with was a Murgo.
How do you know?
Anhig asked shrewdly. Geryon looked at him helplessly, unable to say Ashrak's name.
Well, boy... King Rodar asked.
Geryon struggled with the words, but nothing would come out.
Maybe. You know this Murgo?
Silk suggested. Geryon nodded, relieved that someone could help him.
You wouldn't know many Murgos,
Silk said, rubbing his nose with one finger.
Was it the one we met in Derin, perhaps, and later in Muros?
The one known as Asherak. Geryon nodded again.
Why didn't you tell us?
I couldn't, Geryon stammered.
Couldn't?
The words wouldn't come out. I don't know why, but I've never been able to talk about him.
Ah, then you have seen him before, Sulk said.
Yes.
And you've never told anybody?
No.
Sulk glanced quickly at Aunt Paul. Is this the sort of thing you might know more about than we would, Bulgara? She nodded slowly.
It's possible to do it. It's never been very reliable, so I don't bother with it myself. It is possible, however.
Her expression grew grim.
The Grolems think it's impressive,
Mr. Wolf said.
Grolems are easily impressed.
Come with me, Geryon, Aunt Paul said.
Not yet, said Wolf.
This is important, she said, her face hardening.
You can do it later.
Let's hear the rest of his story first. The damage has already been done. Go ahead, Geryon. What else did you see?
Geryon took a deep breath. All right, he said, relieved to be talking to the old man instead of the king's. I saw the man in the green cloak again that day we all went hunting. He met in the forest with a yellow-haired man who doesn't wear a beard. They talked for a while, and I could hear what they were saying. The yellow-haired man wanted to know what all of you were saying in this hall.
You should have come to me immediately, King Anheg said.
Well, anyway, I had that fight with the wild boar. I hit my head against a tree and was stunned. I didn't remember what I'd seen until this morning, after King Folrak called Durnik here. I went exploring. I was in a part of the palace where the roof is all fallen in, and I found some footprints. I followed them, and then after a while I saw the man in the green cloak again. That was when I remembered all of this. I followed him, and he went along a corridor that passes somewhere over the top of this hall. He hid up there and listened to what you were saying.
How much do you think he could hear, Geryon?
King Kohag asked. You were talking about somebody called the Apostate, and you were wondering if he could use some power of some kind to awaken an enemy who's been asleep for a long time. Some of you thought you ought to warn the Erens and the Tonedrans, but Mr. Wolf didn't think so, and Durnik talked about how the men of Sindaria would fight if the Angoraks came.
They appeared startled.
I was hiding not far from the man in the green cloak. I'm sure he could hear everything that I could. Then some soldiers came, and the man ran away. That's when I decided that I ought to tell Barak about all of this.
Up there, Silk said, standing near one of the walls and pointing at a corner of the ceiling of the hall. The mortars crumbled away. The sound of our voices carries right up through the cracks between the stones into the upper corridor. This is a valuable boy you've brought with you, Lady Pulgara, King Rodar said gravely. If he's looking for a profession, I think I might find a place for him. Gathering information is a rewarding occupation, and he seems to have a certain natural gifts along those lines.
He has some other gifts as well, said Aunt Paul.
He seems to be very good at turning up in places where he's not supposed to be.
Don't be too hard on the boy, Pulgara, King Anheg said. He has done us a service that we may never be able to repay.
Geryon bowed again and retreated from Aunt Paul's steady gaze.
Cousin, Anheg said then to Beric, it seems that we have an unwelcome visitor somewhere in the palace. I think I'd like to have a little talk with this lurker and a green cloak. I'll take a few men, Beric said grimly. We'll turn your palace upside down, and we will shake it and see what falls out.
I'd like to have him more or less intact, Anheg cautioned.
Of course.
Not too intact, however. As long as he's still able to talk, he will serve our purposes. Beric grinned.
I'll make sure that he's talkative when I bring him to you, cousin.
A bleak, answering grin touched Anheg's face, and Barak started toward the door. Then Anheg turned to Barak's wife.
I'd like to thank you also, Lady Merrill. I'm sure you had a significant part in bringing this to us.
I don't need your thanks, Majesty. It was my duty.
Anheg sighed. Must it always be duty, Merrill?
What else is there?
A very great deal, actually. But you are going to have to find that out for yourself.
Geryon, Aunt Paul said, come here.
Yes, ma'am, Geryon said, and went to her a little nervously.
Don't be silly, dear. I'm not going to hurt you.
She put her fingertips lightly to his forehead.
Well,
Mr. Wolf asked.
It's there. It's very light, or I would have noticed it before. I'm sorry, Father.
Let's see, Wolf said.
He came over and also touched Geryon's head with his hand.
It's not serious.
It could have been, and it was my responsibility to see that something like this did not happen.
Don't flog yourself about it, Paul. It's very unbecoming.
just get rid of it.
What's the matter? Geryon asked, alarmed. It's nothing to worry about, dear, Aunt Paul said. She took his right hand and touched it for a moment to the white lock of her brow. Geryon felt a surge, a welter of confused impressions, and then a tingling wrench behind his ears. A sudden dizziness swept over him, and he would have fallen if Aunt Paul had not caught him.
Who is the Murgo?
She asked, looking into his eyes.
His name is Asherak, Geryon said promptly. How long have you known him?
All my life. He used to come to Faldor's farm and watch me when I was little.
That's enough for now, Paul. Let him rest a little first. I'll fix him something to keep it from happening again.
Is the boy ill?
King Kohag asked.
It's not exactly an illness, Kohag, Mr. Wolf replied.
It's a little hard to explain. It's cleared up now, though.
I want you to go to your room, Geryon,
Aunt Paul said, still holding him by the shoulders.
Are you steady enough on your feet to get there by yourself?
I'm all right, he said, still feeling a little light-headed.
No side trips, no more exploring.
No, ma'am. When you get there, lie down. I want you to think back and remember every single time you have seen this Murgo, what he did, what he said.
He's never spoken to me. He just watched. I'll be along in a little while, and I'll want you to tell me everything you know about him. It's important, Geryon, so concentrate as hard as you can.
All right, Aunt Paul.
Then she kissed him lightly on the forehead.
Run along now, dear.
Feeling strangely lightheaded, Geryon went to the door and out into the corridor. He passed through the great hall where Anhag's warriors were belting on swords and picking up vicious-looking battle axes in preparation for the search of the palace. Still bemused, he went through without stopping. Part of his mind seemed half asleep, but that secret inner part was wide awake. The dry voice observed that something significant had just happened. The powerful compulsion not to speak about Asherak was obviously gone. Aunt Paul had somehow pulled it out of his mind entirely. His feeling about that was oddly ambiguous. That strange relationship between himself and the dark-robed, silent Asherak had always been intensely private, and now it was gone. He felt vaguely empty and somehow violated. He sighed and went up the broad stairway toward his room. There were a half-dozen warriors in the hallway outside his room, probably part of Barak's search for the man in the green cloak. Geryon stopped. Something was wrong, and he shook off his half-daze. This part of the palace was much too populated to make it very likely that the spy would be hiding here. His heart began racing, and step by step he began to back away toward the top of the stairs he had just climbed. The warriors looked like any other Charaks in the palace, bearded, dressed in helmets, mail shirts and furs. But something didn't seem exactly right. A bulky man in a dark hooded cloak stepped through the doorway of Geryon's room into the corridor. It was Asherak. The Murgo was about to say something, but then his eyes fell on Geryon.
Ah,
he said softly. His dark eyes gleamed in his scarred face.
I have been looking for you, Geryon,
he said in that same soft voice.
Come here, boy.
Geryon felt a tentative tug at his mind that seemed to slip away, as if it somehow could not get a sure grip. He shook his head mutely and continued to back away.
Come along now, Asherak said. We have known each other far too long for this. Do as I say. You know that you must.
The tug became a powerful grasp that again slipped away.
Come here, Geryon,
Asherak commanded harshly. Geryon kept backing away step by step. No! Asherak's eyes blazed, and he drew himself up angrily. This time it was not a tug or a grasp, but a blow.
Garion could feel the force of it, even as it somehow seemed to miss or be deflected. Ashrak's eyes widened slightly, then narrowed.
"Who did this?"
he demanded.
"Balgrath. Belgrath. It won't do any good, Garion. I had you once. I can take you again any time I want to. You're not strong enough to refuse me."
Garion looked at his enemy and answered out of some need for defiance.
"Maybe I'm not. But I think you'll have to catch me first."
Asherak turned quickly to his warriors.
"That's the boy I want. Take him."
Smoothly, almost as if it were done without thought, one of the warriors raised his bow and leveled an arrow directly at Garion. Ashrak swung his arm quickly and knocked the bow aside, just as the steel-pointed shaft was loosed. The arrow sang in the air and clattered against the stones of the wall a few feet to Garion's left.
"Alive, idiot!"
Ashrak snarled and struck the bowman a crushing blow to the side of the head. The bowman fell, twitching, to the stone floor. Garion spun, dashed back to the stairs, and plunged down, three steps at a time. He did not bother to look back. The sound of heavy feet told him that Ashrak and his men were after him. At the bottom of the stairs, he turned sharply to the left and fled down a long, dark passageway that led back into the maze of Anheg's palace.
Chapter 18. There were warriors everywhere, and the sounds of fighting. In the first instant of his flight, Garion's plan had been simple. All he had to do was to find some of Barak's warriors, and he would be safe. But there were other warriors in the palace as well. The Earl of Yarvik had led a small army into the palace by way of the ruined wings to the south, and fighting raged in the corridors. Garion quickly realized that there was no way he could distinguish friend from enemy. To him, one Kerak warrior looked the same as another. Unless he could find Barak or someone else he recognized, he did not dare reveal himself to any of them. The frustrating knowledge that he was running from his friends as well as his enemies added to his fright. It was altogether possible, even quite likely, that he would run from Barak's men directly into the arms of Jarvik's. The most logical thing to do would be to go directly back to the council hall. But in his haste to escape from Ashrak, he had run down so many dim passageways and turned so many corners that he had no idea where he was or how to get back to the familiar parts of the palace. His headlong flight was dangerous. Ashrak or his men could wait around any corner to seize him, and he knew that the Murgo could quickly re-establish that strange bond between them that Aunt Paul had shattered with her touch. It was that which had to be avoided at any cost. Once Ashrak had him again, he would never let go. The only alternative to him was to find some place to hide. He dodged into another narrow passageway and stopped, panting, and with his back pressed tightly against the stones of the wall. Dimly, at the far end of this hallway, he could see a narrow flight of worn stone steps twisting upward into the flickering light of a single torch. He quickly reasoned that the higher he went, the less likely he would be to encounter anyone. The fighting would most likely be concentrated on the lower floors. He took a deep breath and went swiftly to the foot of the stairs. Halfway up, he saw the flaw in his plan. There were no side passages on the stairs, no way to escape, and no place to hide. He had to get to the top quickly, or chance discovery and capture. Or even worse.
"Boy!"
A shout came from below. Garion looked quickly over his shoulder. A grim-faced Kerak in mail and helmet was coming up the stairs behind him, his sword drawn. Garion started to run, stumbling up the stairs. There was another shout from above, and Garion froze. The warrior at the top was as grim as the one below, and wielded a cruel-looking axe. He was trapped between them. Garion shrank back against the stones, fumbling for his dagger, though he knew it would be of little use. Then the two warriors saw each other, With ringing shouts, they both charged. The one with the sword rushed up past Geryon, while the one with the axe lunged down. The axe swung wide, missed, and clashed a shower of sparks from the stones of the wall. The sword was more true. With his hair standing on end in horror, Geryon saw it slide through the downward plunging body of the axeman. The axe fell clattering down the stairs, and the axeman, still falling on top of his opponent, pulled a broad dagger from its sheath at his hip and drove it into the chest of his enemy. The impact as the two men came together tore them from their feet, and they tumbled, still grappling together down the stairs, their daggers flashing as each man struck again and again. In helpless horror, Geryon watched as they rolled and crashed past him, their daggers sinking into each other with sickening sounds, blood spurting from their wounds like red fountains. Geryon retched once, clenched his teeth tightly, and ran up the stairs, trying to close his ears to the awful sounds coming from below as the two dying men continued their horrid work on each other. He no longer even considered stealth. He simply ran, fleeing more from that hideous encounter on the stairs than from Asherak or the Earl of Yarvik. At last, after how long he could not have said, gasping and winded, he plunged through the partially open door of a dusty, unused chamber. He pushed the door shut and stood trembling with his back against it. There was a broad, sagging bed against one wall of the room, and a small window set high in the same wall. Two broken chairs leaned wearily in the corners, and an empty chest. Its lid open in a third, and that was all. The chamber was at least a place out of the corridors where savage men were killing each other, but Geryon quickly realized that the seeming safety here was an illusion. If anyone opened this door, he would be trapped. Desperately, he began to look around the dusty room. Hanging on the bare wall across from the bed were some drapes, and thinking that they might conceal some closet or adjoining chamber, Geryon crossed the room and pulled them aside. There was an opening behind the drapes, though it did not lead into another room, but instead into a dark, narrow hall. He peered into the passageway, but the darkness was so total that he could only see a short distance into it. He shuddered at the thought of groping through that blackness with armed men pounding along at his heels. He glanced up at the single window and then dragged the heavy chest across the room to stand on it so that he could see out. Perhaps he might be able to see something from the window that would give him some idea of his location. He climbed up on the chest, stood on his tiptoes, and looked out. Towers loomed here and there amid the long slate roofs of the endless galleries and halls of King Unheg's palace. It was hopeless. He saw nothing that he could recognize. He turned back toward the chamber and was about to jump down from the chest when he stopped suddenly. There, clearly in the dust which lay heavily on the floor, were his footprints. He hopped quickly down and grabbed up the bolster from the long, unused bed. He spread it out on the floor and dragged it around the room, erasing the footprints. He knew that he could not completely conceal the fact that someone had been in the room, but he could obliterate the footprints, which, because of their size, would immediately make it obvious to Asherak or any of his men that whoever had been hiding here was not yet full grown. When he finished, he tossed the bolster back onto the bed. The job was not perfect, but at least it was better than it had been. Then there was a shout in the corridor outside, and the ring of steel on steel. Geryon took a deep breath and plunged into the dark passageway behind the drapes. He had gone no more than a few feet when the darkness in the narrow passage became absolute. His skin crawled at the touch of the cobwebs on his face, and the dust of years rose chokingly from the uneven floor. At first he moved quite rapidly, wanting more than anything to put as much distance between himself and the fighting in the corridor as possible. But then he stumbled, and for one heart-stopping instant it seemed that he would fall, The picture of a steep stairway dropping down into the blackness flashed through his mind, and he realized that at his present pace there would be no possible way to catch himself. He began to move more cautiously, one hand on the stones of the wall and the other in front of his face to ward off the cobwebs which hung thickly from the low ceiling. There was no sense of time in the dark, and it seemed to Geryon that he had been groping for hours in this dark hallway that appeared to go on forever. Then, despite his care, he ran full into a rough stone wall. He felt a moment of panic. Did the passageway just end here? Was it a trap? Then, flickering at one corner of his vision, he saw dim light. The passageway did not end, but rather made a sharp turn to the right. There seemed to be a light at the far end, and Geryon gratefully followed it. As the light grew stronger, he moved more rapidly, and soon he reached the spot that was the source of the light. It was a narrow slot low in the wall. Geryon knelt on the dusty stones and peered out. The hall below was enormous, and a great fire burned in a pit in the center, with the smoke rising to the openings in the vaulted roof which lofted even above the place where Geryon was. Though it looked much different from up here, he immediately recognized King Anheg's throne room. As he looked down, he saw the gross shape of King Rhodar and the smaller form of King Khohag, with the ever-present Hetar, standing behind him. Some distance from the thrones, King Tholrak stood in conversation with Mr. Wolf, and nearby was Aunt Paul. Barak's wife was talking with Queen Aelina, and the Queen Porin and Queen Silar stood not far from them. Silk paced the floor nervously, glancing now and then at the heavily guarded doors. Geryon felt a surge of relief. He was safe. He was about to call down to them when the great door banged open, and King Anheg, mail-shirted and with his sword in his hand, strode into the hall, closely followed by Barak and the Raven Warder, holding between them the struggling form of the flaxen-haired man Geryon had seen in the forest on the day of the boar hunt.
"This treason will cost you dearly, Jarvik," Anheg said grimly over his shoulder as he strode toward the throne.
"Is it over, then?"
"Soon, Pilgara. My men are chasing the last of Jarvik's brigands, and the first that reaches of the palace. If we had not been warned, it might have gone quite differently, though."
Geryon, his shout still hovering just behind his lips, decided at the last instant to stay silent for a few more moments. King Anheg sheathed his sword and took his place on his throne.
"We will talk for a bit, Jarvik, before what must be done is done."
The flaxen-haired man gave up his hopeless struggle against Barak and the almost equally powerful Brand.
"I don't have anything to say, Anheg. If the luck had gone differently, I'd be sitting on your throne right now. I took my chance, and that's the end of it."
"Not quite. I want the details. You might as well tell me. One way or another, you are going to talk."
"Oh, do your worst, then," Jarvik sneered. "I'll bite my own tongue before I tell you anything."
"We will see about that," Anheg said grimly.
"That won't be necessary, Anheg," Aunt Paul said, walking slowly toward the captive. "There's an easier way to persuade him."
"I'm not going to say anything. I am a warrior, and I am not afraid of you, witch woman."
"You're a greater fool than I thought, Lord Jarvik."
"Would you rather I did it, Paul?"
said Mr. Wolf.
"I can manage it, father."
She said it, not taking her eyes off of Jarvik.
"Carefully," the old man cautioned. "Sometimes you go to extremes. Just a little touch is enough."
"I know what I'm doing, old wolf."
She stared full into the captive's eyes. Geryon, still hidden, held his breath. The Earl began to sweat and tried desperately to pull his eyes away from Aunt Paul's gaze, but it was hopeless. Her will commanded him, locking his eyes. He trembled and his face grew pale. She made no move, no gesture, but merely stood before him,
her eyes burning into his brain. And then, after a moment, he screamed. And he screamed again, and collapsed, his weight sagging down in the hands of the two men who held him. "Take it away," he whimpered, shuddering uncontrollably. "I'll talk, but please take it away." Silk, now lounging near Anheg's throne, looked at Hetar. I do wonder what he saw.
I think it might be better not to know, Hetar replied.
Queen Ailina had watched intently, as if hoping to gain some hint of how the trick was done. She winced visibly when Jarvik screamed, pulling her own eyes away.
All right, Jarvik, Anheg said, his tone strangely subdued now. Begin at the beginning. I want it all.
It was a little thing at first, Jarvik said, his voice shaking. There didn't seem to be any harm in it.
There never does, said Brand.
The Earl drew in a deep breath, glanced once at Aunt Paul, and shuddered again. Then he straightened.
It started about 2 years ago. I had sailed to Kotu and Drasnia. I met a Nadrak merchant named Greshnor there. He seemed to be a good enough fellow. And after we'd gotten to know each other, he asked me if I'd be interested in a profitable venture. I told him that I was an earl, and not a common merchant or tradesman, but he persisted. He said he was nervous about the pirates who live on the islands in the Gulf of Carrick, and an earl's ship manned by armed warriors was not likely to be attacked. His cargo was a single chest, not very large. I think it was some jewels he had managed to smuggle past the customs houses in Boktor, and he wanted them delivered to Drerin in Sundaria. I said I wasn't really interested, but then he opened his purse and poured out that gold. The gold was bright red, I remember, and I couldn't seem to take my eyes off of it. I did need money. Well, who doesn't, after all? And I really couldn't see any dishonor in doing what he asked. Anyway, I carried him and his cargo to Drerin and met his associate, a Murgo named Asharak.
Garion started at the name, and he heard Silk's low whistle of surprise.
As we had agreed, Asharak paid me a sum equal to what Grashaw had given me, and I came away from the affair with a whole pouch of gold. Asharak told me that I'd done them a great favor, and that if I ever needed more gold, he would be happy to find ways for me to earn it. I now had more gold than I've ever had at one time before, but it somehow seemed it wasn't enough. For some reason, I felt I needed more.
It is the nature of Angarak gold, Mr. Wolfe said. It calls to its own. The more one has, the more it comes to possess him. That's why Murgos are so lavish with it. Asharak was not buying your services, Jarvik. He was buying your soul.
Jarvik nodded, his face gloomy. At any rate, it wasn't long before I found an excuse to sail to Drerin again. Asharak told me that since Murgos are forbidden to enter Carrick, he had developed a great curiosity about us and our kingdom. He asked me many questions, and he gave me gold for every answer. It seemed to me to be a foolish way to spend money. But I gave him the answers and took his gold. When I came back to Carrick, I had another pouch full. I went to Jarvik's home and put the new gold with what I already had. I saw that I was a rich man, and I still had not done anything dishonorable. But now it seemed that there wasn't enough hours in the day. I spent all of the time locked in my strong room, counting my gold, over and over, polishing it until it gleamed red as blood, and filling my ears with the sound of its tinkling. Ah, but after a while, it seemed I didn't really have very much.